From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
What we are witnessing is a microcosm in the Philippines of U.S. military globalization, clearly related, in my mind, to economic globalization. Think of the Pentagon as a World Trade Organization with weapons of mass destruction, and the World Trade Center organization, and the World Trade Organization as the Pentagon of free marketeers.
Today, we'll talk about the U.S., Philippines, and empire. But first, Britain's longest-serving member of parliament is coming under fire for talking about Tony Blair's, quote, Jewish cabal. Today, a debate between the longest-serving member of parliament and the head of the World Zionist Federation. Then, no weapons of mass destruction have been found in Iraq. We'll speak with Washington Post reporter Barton Gellman. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 10 Americans have been killed in a series of simultaneous car bomb attacks last night in the Saudi Arabian capital of Riyadh. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell said, quote, there was a large loss of life of others. Agence France-Presse report the total death toll to be about 20. At least 50 more people were injured. The attacks came just hours before Powell landed in Saudi Arabia for a visit. No one's claimed responsibility for the attacks, but Powell said the bombings, quote, had the earmarks of Al-Qaeda. Last Monday night, attackers reportedly shot their way into three gated compounds housing Western corporate executives and then set off car bombs. Among the injured were three Boeing employees who were in Saudi Arabia training the Saudi Air Force to operate the new Boeing jets. Saudi officials said today they believe they almost caught the suspects last week when the Saudi government issued an all-points bulletin for 19 men, 17 of whom are Saudi citizens, on suspicion of planning attacks. The suspects had fled after a shootout with security forces in Riyadh last Tuesday, according to police. 2 days later, Saudi authorities seized tons of explosives and equipment that could be used in terrorist attacks. The bombing marks the third attack against U.S. interests in Saudi Arabia since 1995. In 1996, a truck bombing killed 19 Americans at Khobar Towers Barracks in Tehran. In 1995, a car bomb exploded at a U.S.-run military training facility in Riyadh. 7 people died, including 5 American advisors to the Saudi National Guard. The Islamic Movement for Change and 2 smaller groups in the region claimed responsibility. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has declared that the question of Jewish settlements, one of the key issues and efforts to reach Middle East peace, is not up for imminent discussion. Speaking to the Jerusalem Post, Sharon said all Israeli governments had gone ahead with settlements in some form, even during periods of peace diplomacy, and that the issue was therefore, quote, not on the horizon. He also said in an address to party members that he would not be put under pressure when he visits Washington to discuss a U.S.-sponsored roadmap to peace, which specifically calls for Israel to stop expanding settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli authorities imposed an extensive blockade on the Gaza Strip yesterday that put the area off limits to most foreigners. The blockade also partially reversed a short-lived peace gesture aimed at easing travel restrictions on Palestinian workers. During Colin Powell's recent visit, Israel announced it would allow Palestinian workers to leave the Palestinian territory for day jobs. This was a measure seen as a small confidence-building step announced during Powell's visit. But as soon as Powell departed, Israel told the Gaza workers to stay home. Iran and the United States have begun holding secret talks in Geneva regarding Iraq and Afghanistan. But officials in Washington and Tehran said the question of resuming diplomatic ties between the two nations is not on the agenda. The U.S. broke off relations with Iran in 1980 after students seized its embassy in Tehran following the Iranian Revolution. Last year, President Bush labeled Iran as part of the axis of evil with North Korea and Iraq. The U.S. military's decision over the weekend to disarm a heavily armed Iraq-based Iranian opposition group, the People's Mujahideen, is seen as a gesture towards Tehran. In Iraq, the British-trained microbiologist Rehab Taha has surrendered to U.S.-backed forces. She has been known as Dr. Germ for her role in Iraq's biological weapons program, but weapons experts differ on how central she was to Saddam Hussein's alleged efforts to build biological weapons in the 1990s. The former chief of staff of the Iraqi Armed Forces, Ibrahim Ahmed Mohammed, is also now in U.S. custody. Few details about his apprehension have been made available. The Bush administration is expected to announce soon it will file suit in the World Trade Organization seeking to overturn a moratorium on genetically altered food crops in most European countries. The administration is on the verge of filing a trade case earlier this year, but shelved it on the eve of the invasion of Iraq to avoid aggravating international tensions. The defense minister of Colombia has threatened to use force against Nicaragua if it begins to explore for oil near the San Andreas Island chain, which both countries claim. The death toll from the suicide attack in Chechnya on a pro-Russian government building has risen to 54 people Tuesday, and rescue workers have given up hope of finding any more. Nearly 200 people were also injured in the truck bomb blast. The United Nations Security Council is discussing sending more peacekeepers to help contain escalating ethnic violence in the northeast of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Some officials have likened recent killings and racial tensions in the area to the start of the Rwandan genocide of 1994. Militias from two ethnic groups, the Lendu Majority and the Hema Minority, have been battling for control of the town of Bunia since Ugandan soldiers withdrew last week under a peace agreement. In Seattle and Chicago, 8,500 people are taking part in the biggest mock terrorist assault in U.S. history. In Seattle, the mock attack dealt with a, quote, dirty bomb going off in a city. Meanwhile, Chicago faced a biological attack. Senator Bob Graham on Sunday accused the Bush administration of engaging in, quote, cover-up of intelligence failures before and after the September 11th attacks to shield it from embarrassment, and said the war with Iraq has allowed al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups to become a greater threat to Americans than ever before. This according to an article in the Los Angeles Times. Graham, a presidential candidate and former chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, also accused the administration of jeopardizing the safety of Americans by blocking the release of a landmark congressional report on the government failures that preceded the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. The Florida Democrat said the White House has withheld from the public important information that the continued existence of terrorist cells in the United States, including some with ties to foreign governments that the U.S. has been afraid to go after.
I remember your face. I remember my promises. I will. Pretty little girl, a picture of the world's biggest smile, burned into my memory like the shelter where you died. You're robbed of your dignity, turned into hospitals with little hope, where there's no medicine, the children die and their mother. mothers, they cry alone. And I remember your face. And I remember my promises. I will remember you to your brothers and sisters. And as I walked among you, I cried. Tears of fear that in your pain my government could find the price worthwhile. The starvation of a wealthy nation and deprivation of medication. 1.6.
I remember. Jessica Sundin here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Australian newspaper is reporting that the mayor of London has launched an outspoken attack against President Bush, branding him corrupt. The mayor, Ken Livingstone, said, "I think George Bush is the most corrupt American president since Warren Harding in the 20s. He is not the legitimate president." Livingstone was answering questions on the Iraq War and other subjects during a two-hour meeting with 200 school children at London City Hall. He added, "The Bush administration really is a completely unsupportable government, and I look forward to it being overthrown as much as I look forward to Saddam Hussein being overthrown." The mayor's outburst was immediately condemned by opposition conservatives and liberal Democrats, who warned it could put Americans off visiting London. Well, another British politician is also coming under fire. His name is Tom Dalziel. He is Britain's longest-serving member of parliament, and he faces an investigation for inciting racial hatred. According to the Guardian newspaper, he accused Tony Blair of being unduly influenced by Jewish ministers and officials. Mr. Dalziel made the remarks in an interview with Vanity Fair magazine, identifying Lord Levy, Tony Blair's Middle East envoy, Peter Mandelson, whose father is Jewish, and Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, who has Jewish ancestry. Mr. Dalziel, who served as an MP for more than 35 years, said, quote, "I'm worried about my country being led up the garden path on a Likudnik, Ariel Sharon agenda." He also added that he felt Mr. Blair was influenced by a, quote, cabal of Jewish advisors. Mr. Dalziel said he used the word cabal in reference to the Bush administration, not Downing Street. Leading British Jews criticized Mr. Dalziel for his, quote, misguided remarks. One of them, Professor Eric Moonman, a former Labour parliamentarian and president of the Zionist Federation in London, said he would refer Mr. Dalziel to the Commission for Racial Equality. We're joined right now by Tom Dalziel, the veteran British Labour MP, known as the Father of the Commons, as well as by Professor Eric Moonman, president of the Zionist Federation of Britain. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Morning. Thank you.
Well, can we start off with Member of Parliament Tom Dalziel? Can you please explain your comments?
Well, they were in the context of a possible attack on Syria. Now, frankly, I don't remember the interview with Vanity Fair, whether it was face-to-face or by telephone. But what I think I said was that I was concerned, yes, I would have used the word cabal, but of course cabal is a small group of people and goes back to an origin in Charles II's time in Britain. There were five people: Clifford, Ashley, Buckingham, Arlington, and Lauderdale, a small group round the center of power. And that, I think, fits exactly what seems to be happening in Washington. These people, particularly Wolfowitz and Pearl, who were writing in 1991 about a preemptive strike against Iraq. And what really bothers me is the rest of this agenda, because I did a debate in Oxford against James Woolsey, the former director of the CIA. We got on very well over dinner. But then he made a speech saying, of course, there would have to be action. not only against Iraq, but Syria, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and yes, Egypt. And that is an agenda which appalls me.
Professor Eric Moonman, your response.
Well, I think that I think one ought to say there's no vendetta against Tam. I think he's given fine service over 40 years, and I've certainly always admired the way in which his diligence has been of value to the House of Commons. I take exception to his remarks, and nothing he's just said alters that, because they are unsubstantiated and highly inflammatory. I can't go into what sort of dinner party he's had with an American, and I really can't get involved with American politics. But what I can say is this, is that the report in front of me from Vanity Fair says that he thinks that Blair is unduly influenced by a cabal of Jewish advisers, and he mentions the three people concerned. And that was immediately laughed out of court here, because Mandelson, one of the three, said, I'm not a Jew. And of course, Lord Levy is a Jew, and Jack Straw, I think you'd have to go back to his granny. But the important thing is, surely, is when Tam Daniel says that Tony Blair is unduly influenced. Again, these words have meaning, and we're not operating in isolation. We have a growing number of racist incidents in Britain. We have a growing number of anti-Semitic incidents. And this is the sort of glory of the extreme right, the British National Party, who did very well in recent elections. So for a Member of Parliament, a Father of the House, to be using phrases like that is something they would probably hesitate to do. And I think, therefore, that I think Tam has got to go a bit further than he has done in his opening remarks by talking about some explanation. The Jewish community, which I'm a member, feels that there ought to be an explanation which he ought to make to the community. All the other stuff is, quite honestly, quite irrelevant to the central issue. Did he or did he not say that the Prime Minister is unduly influenced by a cabal of Jewish advisers? Because that's a very serious charge.
Tam Daniel.
Well, what I said was that I think, because it was some time ago, that it would fall on fertile ground. The bells that you hear in the background are division bells. I'm sorry about this, but we can go on for another 5 minutes if that's okay. What else do you want to ask me?
Let me ask you about comments in The Guardian. It says, the cabal I referred to was in the U.S., that is the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. I was thinking of U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, Defense
yes,
Advisor
Feith,
Richard Perle,
and Bolton,
Douglas
and
Feith,
people of great influence.
Elliot Abrams, Ari Fleischer, Ken Edelman. Those people drive this policy.
Ken Edelman has been repeatedly taking a hard line on British television.
Professor Moonman, would you like to respond?
Well, I'm getting increasingly confused by this this discussion. My position is very clear. I'm a Jew. I've served in the British Army, and I've served in Parliament for 10 years. I would never, never have made the remarks that attributed to Tam regarding a minority group of people. First of all, because it's quite untrue. And by the way, some of his references to the cabal in Washington, I don't think stands up by the evidence, but that's another story. But what I do know about is the British political scene. I'm very close to it. And therefore, what I do think is that Tam has got to come to terms, and I believe he's an honest man, and he will. And I've stressed it before, and I think Tam knows this, that Tam is not anti-Semitic. He is a person I think has somehow been diverted from the essential point that I understand what he's making. But when you talk about a cabal of Jews, that's offensive, it's inflammatory, it's the sort of thing, if he'd made about the black community, there would be a mighty riot indeed in this country. And those are the things that all of us have to be so careful about. Increasingly, the media is anxious to, quite nicely, that's why we're on your radio program, but we are increasingly concerned about the words we use, and we can all have 50 minutes of glory. Tam is not that sort of person, and that's why I'm appealing to him to retract, to apologize to my community, as I certainly wouldn't hesitate to do to a minority community.
Look, What I'm concerned about is an extreme Likudnik Sharon agenda. I mean, heaven knows, if Yitzhak Rabin had not been brutally murdered, this situation and anything like it would never have happened. Frankly, Eric, it's what some of us see as an extreme agenda in Washington. And when you see the desolation in Baghdad at the moment, and apparently, you know, no weapons of mass destruction, which was a justification for going to war. Look, Angie, I am terribly sorry. You heard the division bells. It's an important division. And I'm afraid I have to go and vote. But thank you very much for having me on your program.
Let me try and help Tam out of his difficulties, because he's right. He has to vote in those circumstances. Are you there, Andrew?
It's Amy, and yes, I'm here.
Yes, okay, all right. Sorry, we're getting bells and wrong names here. Look, I think what I can say is this. I think I've made my position clear. I'm not going to repeat it in Tam's absence. I will continue to invite Tam to make that apology. I think that the more he extends this argument, the more he does his case harm. The original issue, and it's available for people to read in the Vanity Fair, and they can see that there is a particular paragraph which is an offensive paragraph to a Jewish person. And therefore, looking to solve problems, because I'm not interested in causing mayhem, I think that Tam should take an early opportunity, and I will appeal for him to do this, to separate his views on Sharon, to separate his views about his lunch and dinner parties with American statesmen, to separate all the sort of prejudice he's got, because he's absolutely obsessed with one of the people, the three mentioned, as he said in a British program. If he can separate all that, then I think Tam could come online and maybe he could understand why he's offended people. There is no cabal. I mean, the joke of a previous Israeli prime minister applies. Jews don't keep secrets. So secret society is what a cabal's about. The idea that three people could actually keep a secret, when even, you know, two people can't keep a secret in the Jewish community, has caused a lot of ripples and a lot of laughter. So therefore, I regret that he said it, and I'm sure that Tam, with fair reasoning, will see this is not the issue. We've got some really important issues to deal with over the next few years, very serious issues. And I'm not unmindful of the role that America has played and what it can play. I'm not unmindful of some of the things that disturb me about the United States. But at the same time, it's an ally. I've spent many happy years working in the United States. I know your country, and indeed my own daughter and my sister are working and have done for many years. So I think that you've got friends. But if we've got friends, we shouldn't fall out over these indiscretions, because it diverts our attention. And I believe ultimately Tam is not like that. Mm.
I'm looking at a piece about this whole controversy that says in Israel's conservative Jerusalem Post, commentator Douglas Davis acknowledged that DL, quote, is the conscience of the party, the voice of its ideological soul, known for speaking out and, when necessary, disagreeing with his leader loudly and publicly. But with his Vanity Fair remark, Davis said, DL is not expressing a lone view. He's giving voice to the darkest thoughts of many others, both within and without his own party. And he's giving, quote, such private thoughts public respectability. He said DL had intended, quote, to embarrass Blair, undermine his leadership, and stir up the movement that was gathering steam before the start of the war to unseat the Labour prime minister. Your response, Professor Eric Moomin, president of the Zionist Federation in Britain, also a former member of parliament. Is that right?
I think that I think there's no doubt that there is concern. As you know, we had votes in the House of Commons giving authority to the prime minister to act, but he received a very substantial majority on two occasions. So there's no question about the prime minister's support. And I have to tell you that his ratings in the opinion polls has shot up, in fact, over the last two or three weeks. But this is by and by. I think that Tam I think, was expressing a very individual point of view. I mean, I've already been, I hope, fair-minded to say that Tam is unusual in the way in which he presents his views. And therefore, he himself is not part of a clique. This is a rather interesting development where he's indicated that there's a Jewish cabal, but he is not part of a clique, and I don't think he really is a sounding board. I regret to say, I think his distress is with one of the three people, and he's made this clear in another program. I think that what we have to do in politics, and I'm still actively involved, is that you've actually got to show some understanding of the why people speak and the way they do things. As far as the Sharon is concerned, and the events surely of the last 10 days make it a little more hopeful. Because some of the big changes that have taken place in initiatives in Israel arose from a right-wing prime minister called Mr. Begin. And it's possible that Barak wouldn't have achieved that much. In fact, his offer of 97% of all that was required to meet the Palestinians' demand was turned down by Arafat. But the two events, I think, have made things a little more hopeful. One is, of course, that there is now a new prime minister, there's a new leader in the Palestinian Authority who I think is no fool and wants to ensure that there is some sort of peace for his people, quite rightly. And the second development is that the leader of the Labour group in Israel has resigned, making way for a new person. If that person turns out to be Shimon Peres, then I think we're beginning to see areas in which peace can be brought about, people who can take chances, because it's a very difficult thing to do because you don't always carry the nation with you. The nation is divided. So I, far from being negative and far from saying, oh my God, what has happened, and in the total of order of things, Tam Dalyell and I are quite insignificant, quite rightly. We have some influence in this country, but we're talking about another country, and that's why I was concerned about Tam offering advice to you in the United States, and I'm not offering advice to people in Israel. But I do believe that if this had been conducted in a different format without reference to the cabal, then Tam and I could have had a very good dialogue, and it might have been ultimately helpful to the British people.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Professor Eric Moonman, president of the Zionist Federation of Britain, and before that, Tam Dalyell, who is a veteran British Labour MP known as the Father of the Commons. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we come back to the United States, we're going to talk with Washington Post reporter Barton Gellman, who's just recently returned from Iraq. The weapons inspectors are leaving Iraq empty-handed. We'll find out what Gellman knows. Stay with us.
Shoot them a wheel.
Ashantytown.
Ruled by the Pampa Bishop.
Ashantytown.
Ruled by a bum of the town.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, Desmond Dekker, Shantytown, here on the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. During the invasion of Iraq, British journalist Jeff Mead asked an indignant Pentagon official if this war was going to make history by, quote, being the first to end before its cause could be found. Well, Mead's premonition appears to be coming true. The group directing the U.S. search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is leaving the country without finding proof that Saddam Hussein possessed chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons. In Sunday's Washington Post, Barton Gellman wrote that survey teams have combed laboratories and munitions plants, bunkers and distilleries, bakeries, file cabinets, and holes in the ground to no avail. The article also said that the frustrated 75th Exploitation Task Force, which was in charge of weapons search, consistently found targets identified by Washington to be inaccurate, looted, and burned. Meanwhile, doctors in Iraq fear that hundreds of Iraqis may be suffering from radiation poisoning following the widespread looting of Iraq's nuclear power facilities. Many residents and villages close to the huge Tuwaitha nuclear facility, about 7 miles south of Baghdad, were showing signs of radiation illness last week, including rashes, acute vomiting, and severe nosebleeds. Alarmed by the reports, the International Atomic Energy Agency last week sent a letter to reiterate earlier demands that the U.S. grant the agency access to Iraq's nuclear sites. But so far, there's been no response. Well, we're joined right now by the Washington Post New York Bureau Chief Barton Gellman. His article, Weapon Hunters Come Up Empty-Handed, appeared in the Washington Post on Sunday. He also reported on the looting of 7 nuclear sites in Iraq, which appeared in the Washington Post this weekend. He's just returned from Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
Well, why don't we start off with the weapons of mass destruction inspectors coming home empty-handed?
Look, I want to make it clear, the search is not over, but the first team is exhausted and going home, and the search is changing dramatically. There is a new group that the Bush administration has spun as a more capable and larger group that the hunt is intensifying. But in fact, that group has a much broader mandate. It's going after evidence of terrorism, foreign intelligence ops, human rights crimes, that sort of thing. And it has actually fewer weapons experts than the original, and that's because they haven't got anything to analyze. They are not finding what they expected to find, which is literally tons of lethal agents, weapons containing them, missile platforms to fire them. They simply haven't come across it, not once.
You write that the Central Command began the invasion with a list of 19 top weapons sites. Only 2 remain to be searched, and another list enumerated 68 top non-WMD sites. Can you talk about these?
Yeah, these numbers contrast somewhat with the ones you tend to hear in Washington. In Washington, they talk about having arrived with 600 overall potential weapons facilities, and that's true. They did have a giant list like that. They call it the Integrated Master Site List, the bureaucracy for everything. But in fact, the ones that they're focused on and the ones that are tracked 3 or 4 times a day and reported up the chain of command are these top 87, 19 were specifically believed to contain weapons or to possibly, probably contain weapons. And the other 68 were not, but they were thought likely to have clues that would help them find the weapons. So they've now gone through most of those, and it hasn't been a close call at all. What it's been is a rout. You've had the great majority of them were emptied, looted, burned. And even with that, it was possible to tell in many cases that they never had anything like what was suspected. You know, you had, for example, a target that was thought to maybe have an underground facility with chemical weapons, and there was nothing underground. It was a boathouse, and it was on top of the water, and there wasn't any place to dig a shelter. And so, in other words, the places where they thought they'd find something, they didn't. And so they now have to do a much, much broader search in which they're counting on Iraqi scientists and former officials to point them places that they have no idea exist.
Barton Gellman, what did General Colin Powell, Secretary of State, say that he would find, that the U.S. military would find in Iraq when it comes to WMDs, weapons of mass destruction?
Well, it was very interesting because even more than the president, I think, February 5th, I think it was, remarks to the United Nations were intended to put the complete credibility of the U.S. government on the line. They chose the cabinet official who has the best reputation overseas, and they had the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, sitting visibly in the camera shot, nodding his head and showing that he endorsed these conclusions. And what Colin Powell said was that a conservative estimate was there would be several hundred tons of lethal chemicals and weaponized biological weapons, weaponized simply meaning that they're put in a delivery vehicle that can send them against an enemy, that there were likely to be well over a dozen remaining Scud missiles, and that there is an ongoing program in some fashion to develop a nuclear weapon, to enrich uranium or to design an implosion device and so on. Up till now, they haven't found the evidence for that. Now, I don't rule out, and I don't think any smart skeptic should rule out, that they will find these things. They have a lot of searching left to do, and they have a lot of scientists and regime figures to debrief, and sometimes these debriefings really do take months. But the early evidence is not optimistic.
What about this other situation where you have all of these people who seem to be suffering from radiation sickness? Can you talk about that?
I am not personally aware of the radiation sickness. I've not seen those reports, and I've certainly not evaluated them myself. Here's what's known. The U.S. searchers have gone so far to seven significant sites of past or present Iraqi nuclear activity. That is to say, either permitted research, storage under seal of known radioactive isotopes, or things like that. They found all of them looted and damaged to some degree. They have not been able to inventory the radioactive sources. So it is not known, not by the U.S. searchers and not by anyone else, to be honest, whether any of the radiological isotopes have actually been taken away. What is known is that some of the containers that used to have them, and which themselves are somewhat radioactive, have been taken away. And there's a difference between radiation that you experience sort of through the air at a distance and radiation that you experience because you've ingested particles, because you stored milk or water in an old container, or because the container is now a bit corroded or damaged and you're breathing them in. Those are much more damaging. Whether people are showing immediate signs, I don't know.
Finally, back in 92, you were leaked a doc copy of the Defense Department's Defense Planning Guidance. Can you talk about the significance of the document, which was written in part by Paul Wolfowitz?
Well, it was written under Wolfowitz's auspices. It was under the policy department of the Pentagon, and it was ultimately withdrawn at that time because it created a bit of a political firestorm. But what it said was that the United States should use its power to preserve a place in the world that it had never had before, that with the end of the Soviet Union, there was no rival superpower. The United States was preeminent in power economically and especially militarily in the world, and it should be the U.S. policy to maintain that status, to prevent the rise of a global competitor. And it had the seeds of a doctrine of preemption. It was not as explicit then as it became under the second Bush administration, but there was a certain intellectual continuity over the years, and also a continuity of the people involved from that 1992 document to the arrival of the new President Bush in power.
Well, Barton Gellman, I want to thank you for being with us, New York Bureau Chief of the Washington Post, just recently returned from Iraq. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, Philippines, U.S., and Empire. Stay with us.
Our world has begun to spin like a Ferris wheel. The threat of world annihilation is getting very real. And what of hope and happiness? Are they forever lost? Or will just step in and prevent another Holocaust? Oh, everybody better wake up. Everybody better wake up. The superpowers better wake up. The world powers better wake up.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Philippines President Gloria Arroyo has called on separatist rebel group Moro Islamic Liberation Front to renounce terrorism, commit itself to the peace process. She spoke during a visit to Corondal, the site of a bomb blast that killed at least 10 people over the weekend. The MILF has consistently denied the government's charge that it was behind the attack. The explosion left a trail of carnage and destruction. Peace talks between government officials and MILF leaders broke down last week following other bomb attacks in the region. We're going to turn right now to Luis Francia, Philippine author and journalist, editor of The Vestiges of War, The Philippine-American War and Aftermath of an American Dream. He spoke recently at New York University.
In his 1900 speech to the U.S. Senate on the Philippine question, Senator Albert Beveridge described the once and future island republic as permanently anchored at the spot selected by the strategy of Providence commanding the Pacific. He then went on to declare that the power that rules the Pacific, therefore, is the power that rules the world, and with the Philippines, that power is and will forever be the American Republic. Indeed, since the 1899 Philippine-American War and the American colonial regime lasting to 1946, the Philippines has been valued by the United States primarily as a gateway to the Southeast Asia-Pacific region and therefore is an essential component of its forward-basing military strategy, where its forces can be deployed throughout the globe and where its wars can be fought far from continental America. It is geography, then, rather than any deeply held fraternal feelings, that makes the Philippines central to both U.S. policy towards the Philippines and to the manner in which successive Philippine governments have accommodated such policy. Even after independence was restored in 1946, the country has remained well within the U.S. orbit, anchoring this neo-colonial relationship and simultaneously serving as an eloquent symbol of it, where Clark Air Force Base and Subic Bay Naval Base, the largest U.S. bases abroad, whose origins date back to the Philippine-American War. The bases were shot down in 1992 by the Philippine Senate after having served the U.S. well in the Asia-Pacific region as staging areas, supply and service depots, and R&R sites as early on as the Boxer Rebellion in China, and especially during the Korean, Vietnam, and Gulf Wars. The long-standing aspiration of Philippine nationalists has been to complete what has been termed the unfinished revolution, a reference to the 1896 revolution against Spain that was effectively aborted by American conquest, with the assertion of independence from the U.S., especially from its foreign policy, seen as a necessary step. And so the shutdown of the bases proved to be a euphoric but relatively brief period of time. And now 9/11 has provided the Bush administration with a perfect cover for its global war on terrorism, reviving proprietary aims towards the archipelago and reinserting itself into Southeast Asia. Employing language reminiscent of the early days of empire, the U.S. once again claims to be intent on spreading democracy and safeguarding American interests, the two somehow perpetually equated, by aggressively eliminating sources of terrorism. President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo was in fact the first Asian leader to fall into lockstep with President Bush. As to be expected from Washington's little brown sister, Manila has proven to be remarkably compliant in the opening of what has been termed the second front against terrorism. Arroyo's enthusiastic support for the war on terrorism, while embarrassing, is unsurprising. The country's strategic placement has always been used as a bargaining lever by successive Philippine presidents to extract economic and military aid from the U.S., aid which essentially dried up when the basis treaty was not renewed in 1991. At the same time, Arroyo projects an image of herself as a decisive leader, more than capable of securing the safety of her constituents in these tough times, mimicking George W. Bush's own domestic concerns. Beyond these obvious enticements, however, Manila has seen in this war on terrorism a convenient path to push its own domestic militarism. Indeed, for both governments, 9/11 and the nebulous war on terrorism has been ingeniously and cynically seized as a Trojan horse to exploit other ends, one regional and global, the other local, while seeming to play the role of avenging angels. Not surprisingly, then, the relationship between the two countries is more accurately defined by three military agreements rather than by any sense of special relations: the Mutual Defense Treaty of 1951, the Visiting Forces Agreement of 1999, and the current agreement, Mutual Logistics Supply Agreement, just signed in last November. The U.S. views its regional presence as crucial to maintain and extend its global dominance militarily, to keep tabs on insurgencies in the Philippines, especially in the south, and on fundamentalist groups in Indonesia and Malaysia, and preventing and disrupting potential links between them and between them and, say, al-Qaeda. Its former colony has once again become a key component in a world order as framed by the Pentagon's preemptive policy, where the U.S. arrogates the right of preemptive strikes against any country that seeks or may possibly seek to challenge its dominance. In Asia, apart from North Korea, the nation with that potential is undeniably China. The war on terrorism has also enabled the Philippine military to push its own agenda to the forefront. Since the martial law regime of Ferdinand Marcos in the 1970s, when the dictator increased the size of the armed forces of the Philippines from 50,000 to 250,000, the army has been a key player in government. This can be seen in a number of events. Marcos's downfall in 1986 was precipitated by a military revolt that triggered what has become known as people power. Corazon Aquino, who succeeded to the presidency upon Marcos's fall, had their government threatened six times by attempted military coups, with one of them nearly succeeding. Fidel Ramos, her successor, is himself a retired general, a leader of the 1986 military rebellion, and chief of staff under Aquino. Joseph Estrada, former movie star and vice president, took office in 1998, only to exit disgracefully from office late in 2000, when, amidst the scandal of impeachment proceedings and a reprise of people power, the military withdrew its support from his government. Arroyo, Estrada's vice president and now the current president, has not been threatened with coups, and this is largely because she has cultivated her relationship with the military and has enthusiastically endorsed a hardline policy towards various insurgencies, notably the Muslim one in Mindanao, the same failed policies followed by Estrada in 2000. The group that both governments have conveniently targeted in this deadly tango is the Abu Sayyaf. But this violent, essentially criminal gang never did and does not now constitute a destabilizing threat to the Philippine government, much less to the U.S. Essentially a kidnap for ransom gang, the Abu Sayyaf, in its pursuit of the dollar, has much more in common with its pursuers than the latter would care to acknowledge. The groups between 60 to 200 armed gunmen are really no match for the Philippine troops deployed against them. If the Philippine military hasn't done so, it isn't for lack of ability, but due to inefficiency and corruption. The AFP has battled three much larger, more sophisticated, ideologically driven armies: the secessionist Moro National Liberation Front in the 1970s, the fundamentalist Moro Islamic Liberation Front, or MILF, since the 1980s, and the Maoist New People's Army, or the NPA, since 1969. There is currently a peace agreement in place between the MNLF and Manila, while intermittent peace talks have been going on between the MILF and Manila, as well as between the National Democratic Front, representing the Communist Party of the Philippines, and its military wing, the NPA, and Manila. Complicating the talks, the U.S. has, however, labeled the NPA as a terrorist organization, and now Manila is thinking of doing the same to the MILF, undermining the peace negotiations, which have stalled due to an ongoing military campaign in central Mindanao against strongholds of the MILF. Additionally, the government ascribes to the MILF recent bombings in the city of Davao in Mindanao, which the MILF denies having undertaken. An equally valid suspect must be the military, which has a notable record of human rights violations and renegade tactics. The focus on the Abu Sayyaf, therefore, is puzzling. If it hadn't been for the kidnapping of Westerners, particularly the Burnhams, American missionaries, the Abu Sayyaf would never have made the evening news. Of course, kidnapping a couple of Americans is always a threat to democracy and the world order, while kidnapping dozens of Filipinos and the odd European isn't. But our puzzlement decreases if we keep in mind that chasing the Abu Sayyaf could very well draw in the main insurgency groups, thereby increasing the chances of a larger war to the delight of the hawks in both governments and providing the occasion for increased U.S. involvement. Clearly, it's bigger fish that Manila and Washington are after. One of the ploys employed by the hawks in this context has been the smooth rhetorical switch from anti-communist to anti-terrorist, reflecting the post-9/11 one-label-fits-all approach that downright ignores crucial differences, ideological, religious, and political, among large sectors of Philippine society whose legitimate social and political grievances underpin the recourse to armed struggle. During martial law, to be a human rights worker, a student activist, or a community grassroots organizer was to risk being labeled a comunista. Even rural church groups such as basic Christian communities were objects of government suspicion. I recall one peasant woman member in a basic Christian community remarking that the military in her barrio seemed to have confused Marx with St. Mark's gospel in their harassment of her group. Such labels can trace their dubious lineage to Spanish and American colonial times, when the favored epithets applied to those resisting Western imperialism were ladrones, or bandits, and outlaws. And of course, there were racialized descriptions. American officers during the Philippine-American War described Filipinos liberally as, quote, savages, Indians, and niggers, close quote. And dating back to Spanish colonial times, the label terrorist and Moro, the Spanish word for Muslim, are synonymous. And there is, too, the implicit assumption that being fundamentalist is synonymous with being a terrorist. Today, neither the aim nor the content has really changed, only the term has. But terrorism, being a broader label, utilized to encompass a criminal gang like the Abu Sayyaf, as well as the NPA, it creates a bigger brush with which to tar government critics of all kinds. Arroyo has responded to critics of her military's policies as being terrorist sympathizers, echoing Bush's own, "You're either with us or against us." The policies of both governments have dovetailed in a series of military exercises termed shoulder to shoulder, balikatan, with the U.S. deploying troops in the Philippines since shortly after 9/11. The outcry over the latest proposed deployment of 1,700 U.S. troops to Jolo, no longer as advisors but as combatants, has raised the potential level of U.S. involvement to even more dangerous levels. The seemingly premature announcement may have, in fact, been a trial balloon to test public opinion. However, recent pronouncements by the AFP indicate that this restriction could very well be ignored. Under the Mutual Logistics Supply Agreement, U.S. forces have access to Philippine military policy facilities and services throughout the country, in effect converting the whole archipelago into a virtual base for the Pentagon without being tied to specifically reserved land and sea areas that would leave the U.S. government open to charges of permanent tenure. The MLSA will render the Philippines a staging ground for what is termed euphemistically, quote, stability operations, close quote, in Southeast Asia. The MLSA should be viewed in relation to the November 2002 U.S.-sponsored ASEAN anti-terror pact to strengthen security cooperation against terrorism in defense of U.S. interests in Southeast Asia. This, of course, leads to Catch-22, for the very presence of U.S. military forces automatically converts into U.S. interests and could create exactly what they seek ostensibly to prevent, terrorist attacks. And we must also consider the matter of the Spratly Islands, which are a group of tiny islands in reefs of about 5 square kilometers, but dispersed over 400,000 square kilometers in central South China Sea between Vietnam and the Philippines, surrounded by rich fishing grounds. They may contain substantial oil and gas deposits. China, Taiwan, and Vietnam claim them in their entirety, while the Philippines and Malaysia claim portions. All five countries have military outposts there. Keeping in mind the Pentagon's preemptive strike policy and the mutual defense treaty between the Philippines and the U.S., the Spratlys could very well become a flashpoint between China and the U.S., with the Philippines as an American surrogate. The direct effects of the war on terrorism in the Philippines so far have been to exacerbate the situation in Mindanao. Militarization has displaced people, created refugees, has disrupted communal ways of life, and led to rampant abuses of human rights. Muslim Filipinos still remember atrocities such as the 1906 massacre of 900 largely defenseless Muslim men, women, and children in Budajo by troops under the command of General Leonard Wood. Rather than addressing fundamental age-old issues of structural reform in the economy, of ensuring a responsive justice system, and an equitable sense of governance, this war on terrorism is itself terroristic and worsens an already dire situation. What we are witnessing is a microcosm in the Philippines of U.S. military globalization, clearly related, in my mind, to economic globalization. Think of the Pentagon as a World Trade Organization with weapons of mass destruction, and the World Trade Center Organization, and the World Trade Organization as the Pentagon of free marketeers. This war on terrorism erodes Philippine sovereignty and violates the Philippine Constitution with the lamentable complicity of the Arroyo government, and thus renders the task of ensuring an independent state finally free of its neo-colonial moorings even more difficult. Thank you.
Lucia Franza, Philippine author and journalist, speaking at New York University Law School last month. That does it for the program. If you'd like to get a video or audio cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. We've just launched a new one. Very special thanks to Eric Goldhagen and Open Flows, StasMedia.com, Chris Abrams, and the whole gang here at Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, help from no rival, Bill Kutsouras, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, with Rich Kim, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When you live with nothing but lies being told you on the media, nothing but lies, and it's done the way they do advertising, it's repetition. Weapons of mass destruction, he's got messages of mass destruction, mass destruction, mass destruction. When you hear that 10,000 times a day, you finally think he must have, you know, they can't go on like this forever. Well, he didn't have them.
Acclaimed essayist and historian Gore Vidal, author of Dreaming War, Blood for Oil, and the Cheney Bush Hunter. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 10 Americans have been killed in a series of simultaneous car bomb attacks last night in the Saudi Arabian capital of Riyadh. Secretary of State General Colin Powell said, quote, there was a large loss of life of others. Agence France-Presse reports the death toll to be at least 20, at least 50 more people were injured. The attacks came just hours before Powell landed in Saudi Arabia. No one has claimed responsibility for the attacks, but Powell said the bombings, quote, the earmark of Al-Qaeda. Late Monday night, attackers reportedly shot their way into three gated compounds housing Western corporate executives and then set off car bombs. Among the injured were three Boeing employees who are in Saudi Arabia training the Saudi Air Force to operate the new Boeing jets. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has declared that the question of Jewish settlements, one of the key issues in efforts to reach Middle East peace, is not up for imminent discussion. He also said in an address to party members that he would not be put under pressure when he visits Washington to discuss the U.S.-sponsored roadmap to peace, which specifically calls for Israel to stop expanding settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. Iran and the United States have begun holding secret talks in Geneva regarding Iraq and Afghanistan, but officials in both Washington and Tehran said the question of resuming diplomatic ties between the two nations is not on the agenda. The Bush administration is expected to announce soon that it will file suit in the World Trade Organization seeking to overturn a moratorium on genetically altered food crops in most European countries. The death toll from the suicide attack in Chechnya on a pro-Russian government building has risen to 54. Nearly 200 people were also injured in the truck bomb blast. The United Nations Security Council is discussing sending more peacekeepers to help contain escalating ethnic violence in the northeast of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Some officials have likened recent killings and racial tensions in the area to the start of the Rwandan genocide of 1994. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Florida Senator Bob Graham said Sunday that he accused the Bush administration of engaging in a, quote, cover-up of intelligence failures before and after the September 11th attacks to shield it from embarrassment, and said the war with Iraq has allowed Al-Qaeda and other groups to become a greater threat to Americans than ever before. This, according to a report in the Los Angeles Times. Graham is a presidential candidate, former chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. He also accused the administration of jeopardizing the safety of Americans by blocking the release of a landmark congressional report on the government failures that preceded the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The Florida Democrat said the White House has withheld from the public important information about the continued existence of terrorist cells in the United States and the foreign governments they may be connected to. Graham's critique in many ways is similar to one that appeared in a book that recently topped the New York Times bestseller list. It's called Dreaming War, Blood for Oil, and the Cheney Bush Hunter. The author is Gore Vidal, one of the most prolific and best-known writers in the United States. He's written more than 22 books. A collection of his essays won the National Book Award. Gore Vidal is the author most recently of Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace and his book Dreaming War. Writing in The Scotsman, critic Gavin Esler called Perpetual War the finest serious critique of America's use and abuse of power in the 21st century that I have read. Well, last week, I had the chance to sit down with Gore Vidal in his hotel room in New York. We're going to play that interview for you. I asked him where he was on September 11, 2001.
The United States is not a normal country. We're a homeland now, under military surveillance and military control. The president asked the Congress, right after 9/11, not to conduct a major investigation as it might deter our search for terrorism, wherever it may be in the world. So Congress obediently rolled over. There was, I remember Pearl Harbor, I was a kid then, and within 3 years of it, I had enlisted in the Army. That's what we did in those days. We did not go off to the Texas Air Force and hide. I realize the country has totally changed, that the government is not responsive to the people, either in protecting us from something like 9/11, which they should have done, could have done, did not do, and then when it did happen, to investigate. So I wrote two little books, one called Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, in which I try to go into the why. Osama bin Laden, if it were he or whoever it was, why it was done. Then I wrote another one, Dreaming War, on why we were not protected at 9/11, which ordinarily would have led to the impeachment of the President of the United States who had allowed it to happen. They said they had no information. Since then, every day, the New York Times prints another mountain of people who said they had warned the government. They had warned the government. President Putin of Russia, he had warned us. President Mubarak of Egypt, he had warned us. Three members of Mossad claimed that they had come to the United States to warn us that sometime in September, something unpleasant might come out of the sky in our direction. Were we defended? No, we were not defended. Has this ever been investigated? No, it hasn't. There was some attempt at the midterm election. There was a pro forma committee in Congress, which has done nothing thus far. What are we, 3 years later? This is shameful. The media, which is controlled by the great conglomerates, which control the political system, has done an atrocious job of reporting, though sometimes good stories get in. I've worn my eyes out studying the Wall Street Journal, which despite its dreadful editorial policies, is a pretty good newspaper of record, which the New York Times is not. If you read the Wall Street Journal very carefully, you can pretty much figure out what happened that day. At the time of the first hijacking, according to law, FAA, it is mandatory within 4 minutes of a hijacking, fighter planes from the nearest airbase, military base, go up to scramble. That means go up and force the plane down, find out who they are, find out what's happening. For 1 hour and 50 minutes, I think it was, no fighter plane went up. During that hour and 20 minutes, we lost the two towers and one side of the Pentagon. Why didn't they go up? No description from the government, no excuse, a lot of mumbling stories which were then retracted and new stories replaced them. That, to me, was the end of the Republic. We no longer had a Congress which would ask questions, which it was supposed in place to do, of the executive. We have a commander-in-chief who likes strutting around in military uniform, which no previous commander-in-chief ever did, as they're supposed to be civilians, keeping charge of the military. This thing is surrealistic now, and it is getting nastier and nastier as we are more and more kept in the dark about those things which most affect us, which are war and peace, prosperity and poverty. These are the main things that a government should look after, and we, the people, should be told about. We have been told nothing, and every voice is silent. So I wrote two little books, which were then noticed by people who like to look at the internet, and then a few hundred thousand people have bought them. And I don't come out with conspiracy theories. I never became a journalist. I'm a historian. Because journalists give you their opinions and pretend they're facts. I don't give you my opinions because they may be valuable to my mother, but they're of no value to anybody else. They may be of value to me. But I give the facts as I find them, and I list them, and they're quite deadly. This government is culpable of, if nothing less, negligence. Why were we not protected with all the air bases, fighter planes up and down the eastern seaboard? Not one of them went aloft while the hijackings took place. Finally, two from Otis Field in Massachusetts arrived at the Twin Towers, I think at the time the second one was hit. If anybody had been thinking, they would have gone on to Washington to try and prevent the attack on the Pentagon. They went back to Otis, back to Massachusetts. So I ask these questions, which Congress should ask, does not ask, which the press should ask, but it's too frightened. It's a reign of terror now.
A recent expose shows that even the congressional committee that's looking into this can't get a hold of documents that are classified, and even public testimony is now being reclassified.
Well, isn't it pretty clear that the dictatorship is in place? We're not supposed to know certain things, and we're not going to know them. They're doing everything to remove our history, to they've damaged the Freedom of Information Act. Bush managed to have a number of presidential papers, including those of his father, put out of reach of historians or anybody for a great length of time, during which they will probably be shredded, so they will never be available. And what I've always called, jokingly, the United States of amnesia will be worse than an amnesiac. It'll be have suffered a lobotomy. There will be no functioning historical memory of our history.
How has George Bush accrued so much power?
Well, the election of 2000 was the end of the Republic. It was the second time it had happened that somebody who got the popular vote didn't get the election. 1876, when Governor Tilden, a Democrat of New York, won the election. But they were able, we still had troops in the South, they were able to turn the election around in the Electoral College. Tilden didn't want another civil war, so he just withdrew. But there was no sinister group taking charge. It was just a party group of Republicans who wanted to continue the reign of General Grant. That was mildly sleazy. This is major corruption. This is corporate America as one putting in place a president who was not elected, getting the Supreme Court to delay and delay, when under the 10th Amendment, every decision about the voting in Florida should be made by the Florida Supreme Court, not the U.S. Supreme Court, which the Constitution rules out in matters of election.
So how did that happen? And how did, well, isn't he your relative, Al Gore?
Well, it's nothing I go through the streets boasting of, no. But yes, he's my cousin. And very un-Gore. The Gores are very known for their belligerency. And he is not known for self-defense, let us say. He should have asked. It's easy to say he should have, but it was pretty clear at the time I would have, had I been in that situation. Count the total Florida vote. He has every right to demand that. And they couldn't have played games because it's too big a vote. Instead, he asked, I think, three counties, Dade and Broward and one other, to do their count over again.
Concerned that he wouldn't win outside of those.
No, I think he figured that he had won those. Dade is certainly a large minority vote, which had all voted for him. There's a wonderful book by Nichols called Jews for Buchanan. And it's a marvelous shot of four Jewish gentlemen looking terribly alarmed. And you see Dade County goes for Buchanan. Even Buchanan said, look, these were not my votes down there. Something's wrong. And it was stolen by the Secretary of State, that lady who has now been rewarded with a seat in Congress, the president's brother, the losing president candidate's brother, was governor, and he took part in it. And the court did by 5-4. Two of the five should have recused themselves, should have just withdrawn from the case when Gore versus Bush came before the court. Why? One of them, Scalia, had a son who was working for the Bush team of lawyers before the Supreme Court. Does Justice Scalia recuse himself, as he should, because his son is arguing? No. He wants to kill Gore. He wants to make sure that the bad guys win. Thomas, wife, was busy getting curricula vitae of potential people to serve in a Bush administration. Clarence Thomas should have recused himself and withdrawn from the case. In which case, it would have been 4-3 for Gore, who would now be president, and Iraq and Afghanistan, I could guarantee, would not have been knocked down in order to benefit Halliburton and Bechtel.
Antonin Scalia recently went to Cleveland. He spoke at the Cleveland City Club, which is known as the oldest free speech forum in the country. He allowed no press in. And the night before, he spoke in the city, and he said that that vote, choosing George Bush, was his proudest moment.
I would impeach him. And in a well-run country, the Senate should make a movement toward the impeachment of, the trial of, anyway, of Justice Scalia. And back of that, there's some interesting organization going on, which was hard to determine, Opus Dei. Both Scalia and Thomas have connections with Opus Dei, which is a secret Catholic order, originally fascist. General Franco in Spain was a sort of godfather to it. And we don't know much about it. And it's all over the place, about 80,000 worldwide. Louis Free of the FBI at that time was a member, as was Mr. Hansen, the spy, who'd been giving all of our secrets to the, he was with the CIA. He'd been giving our secrets to the Russians for many years. I make no charges, but I simply bring up questions. Why not ask questions of these people? Does it suit Opus Dei that Bush is president? Now we're getting into God territory, which I normally would stay away from, as any good American should. It's not my business, other people's religions. But Bush is born again. That's why he uses biblical language. He's evil, he evil, he evil doer. Well, that's theological language. You can say he's a bad man, he's a dishonest man, ruthless man, evildoer. And he believes the end of the world is coming. He's a born-agains believe in rapture. They don't care about this world. When it ends, he's going to be lifted up. George W. Bush will be lifted up in a state of rapture into the bosom of our Lord. Also, among the born-again category, though not that kind of Protestant, is Tony Blair, who has become, like his wife, Roman Catholic, which is difficult for a British prime minister, since the prime minister is supposed to be an Anglican, what we would call Episcopalian, as he picks the bishops of the Anglican Church. So you can't have a Roman Catholic picking Anglican bishops. But he is. So now we have two boys who think that Jesus wants them for sunbeams, who are willing to put at risk. I'm extrapolating on my own just from the evidence at hand. This is mostly humorous. You can judge it as you may. But two believers in our Lord's coming, and Armageddon, and the end of the world. This is the way Ronald Reagan used to talk, and made him very popular in the southern states. That's why they big thing was just now about South Carolina. That's the heart of it. Why? Well, those states don't have much in the way of population, but they have very strong, born-again, evangelical Christians, Protestants, and they believe in our Lord returning at any moment. And if you can collect them all by saying you hate abortion and this and that, they are the swing vote in those states. because of the Electoral College. They don't have much population, but they have a lot of electoral votes among them. The Electoral College was devised. You call yourself democracy. You're very un-American. The Founding Fathers did not want democracy in the United States ever. They also did not want tyranny, a king or a Hitler. They wanted a republic. And they devised the Electoral College so the majority could never control anything. So you have a popular vote out there. In those days, it was just for Congress. Then there was one electoral vote per congressman, one per senator in the state, and some other officials. And they get together and decide the election. So what Scalia was doing is he was going back to the Electoral College in order to put together a majority to put in his candidate, who will probably hasten the end of the world. I don't know where Scalia will be during rapture. He may be, or he may be.
He pointed up and then pointed down. Gore Vidal, essayist and historian, author of Dreaming War. We'll be back with him in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Gore Vidal, essayist, critic, author. He was in Italy on September 11th when he tuned in to CNN. First thing he saw, a plane going into the tower. Today, he talks about the significance and aftermath of 9/11, his book, Dreaming War, Blood for Oil, and the Cheney-Bush Junta, as we continue with the interview with essayist and historian Gore Vidal.
You're talking about religion. You've written about Pat Robertson and about John Ashcroft.
Yes, I have. They are very religious men. The wall that Thomas Jefferson thought that he had built, as did John Adams, who was pretty much of an antagonist of Jefferson, but they were both agreed that religion ought not to in any way intrude itself into politics. Was something quite separate. Whatever your religion, you obeyed its laws if you believed in those laws. Nobody would stop you. But once you start raising money in tax-free institutions that, whose tax-free money you use to influence elections, like Mr. Robinson and Mr. Falwell, then you're out of the Constitution. And you should be taxed anyway before you use it. But they are free of taxation. And with that, the whole country began to change. And this very small minority of evangelicals, mostly in the South and Southwest, have achieved great power in states of small population, where their electoral college count, state by state, adds up to quite a lot. In fact, added up to a Bush, quote, victory, unquote.
Gore Vidal, you've said, I don't see us winning this war. You've also said that this will force Saddam Hussein to use whatever weapons of mass destruction he may have. Maybe you were prophetic, and maybe, in fact, that was true, that if he had them, he would have used them, and he didn't.
Well, it's pretty plain he didn't have them, and nobody in Europe thought he did. The Europeans at least have a free press, which we don't, or most of the countries there do. I said he probably would if we pressed him hard enough. It never, you see, when you live with nothing but lies being told you on the media, nothing but lies, and it's done the way they do advertising, it's repetition. Weapons of mass destruction. He's got mass destruction. When you hear that 10,000 times a day, you finally think he must have, you know, they can't go on like this forever. Well, he didn't have them. Now I'm sure we're busy planting them, you know, all over the place, and we will discover, oh, look what we found. Goodness me, here's an atom bomb made in USA. No, scratch that out. That's, he made that mark. I fully expect us to plant something or other, but as it's United States of Amnesia, why go to the trouble? It's expensive to have troops going around looking for stuff. I think they think the public will have forgotten it, and I think the public is forgetting it, doesn't much care. I thought when I said that we would lose the war, I still think we will. Afghanistan, the fighting is going on, rather rougher than it was during the so-called war. It'll keep right on going as long as we have a presence in Iraq, and we will eventually be driven out. Somebody will have a bright idea, one of those neoconservatives, and we know what they're like, will decide to kill everybody there, that this would be a very good thing to do. Got to show force. And all these sissies, you know, all of whom ran from the idea of going into the army, talk so tough when they get together. Boy, we're going to show our muscle. And you look at Mr. Crystal and Mr. Oh, he's the sidekick that writes with him. You know, fat boys with asthma talking tough. Makes the blood run cold. So I think that we haven't a chance of winning in the Middle East. Nobody else has. Nobody except the Turks with the Ottoman Empire, which Woodrow Wilson, one of the great fools in our history, decided to break up after the end of World War I. So we get Turkey, which turns out to be really quite a formidable country now, and broke up bits and pieces into Syria, into Jordan, into this, into that, which had formerly been, then became French and British mandates, and then there are now countries that are uneasy with all sorts of warring religious groups.
Gore Vidal, you developed a relationship with Timothy McVeigh. Can you talk about that?
I never met him, nor did we ever speak on the telephone, but we exchanged letters. He read a piece I wrote in Vanity Fair about the shredding of the Bill of Rights, which has been further shredded since his death. And he read it and wrote me a letter, and I wrote him back, and he wrote me some very informative letters about himself. He was very smart, knew the Constitution backwards and forwards. I was struck by reading about his trial. At first, I had no interest, you know. He was the lone crazed killer that our public must always have. Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. We all know that. I even get a big, you know, the Warren Commission to say that. He was obviously not alone. And it's always a lone crazed killer. Well, that worked so well then, and the people fall for it every time, so they decided that Timothy McVeigh, a rather slight young man with no knowledge of explosives, had put together this, I think it's a 2-ton bomb, which he himself and a guy called Nichols loaded on a Ryder truck. It took at least 9 people, it's been figured out, to get that bomb onto that truck. And then a very careful, experienced driver to get that thing without blowing himself up into Oklahoma City in front of the Mora building. He was not alone, and we have a pretty good idea of some of the people he was associated with who might have been in on it. The FBI began quite professionally, pretty well. They had infiltrated a lot of these patriot movements out there in the Middle West, people who don't like the government, and others who were angry, as was McVeigh, at what the federal government had done with the Branch Davidians at Waco. For McVeigh, this was revenge upon what he regarded as an odious government, a tyrannical government. He'd gone out there and watched them using military, army stuff. And remember, he was an army hero of the Gulf War. And he watched them break the law, the Posse Comitatus Act of 1876, I think it was. And in one of the letters to me, these are all reprinted in Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, if you want to read McVeigh's actual words about it. He said, you know, soldiers are trained to kill. The police are trained to protect persons and property. These are two different functions. The Justice Department called in the army. They wanted tanks, they wanted all sorts of things, army material, with which they shot up the buildings, set fire to it, and the people died. There was, once again, no proper investigation. In the course of McVeigh's trial, which was a kind of joke, the FBI behaved pretty well. I mean, they had a lot of interesting leads. 305s, I think they're called. They take down the evidence that people give them, directions in which to look, and so on. They followed up nothing. And I wrote Louis Free, who was then the head of the FBI, a letter which I include in the little book, a letter which I read aloud on the Today Show, just to make sure that he saw it. No answer, but I said, why don't you? There's certain very interesting leads here. And this is all from evidence of the pretrials, which anybody could get at. And I said, these should have been investigated, but they weren't. They decided it was McVeigh, and that was it, period. Now, a couple of days ago, we find out the FBI was faking it, some anti-McVeigh stuff in their labs, trying to prove that he'd built the bomb. He had ammonia on his trousers or something. Well, he may well have been in on it. I don't know. I'm not a prophet. But it's my impression that he could not have done it alone. So there were others to follow up. And on television, I said, you know, you've got to start doing your job at the FBI, at the Justice Department. Your job is to protect persons and property. You didn't follow up. There may be 100 McVeighs out there waiting to take another crack at us. And you did nothing. Because you wanted one lone crazed killer, and you wanted the book shut. So what sort of government is this? I'd say a bad one.
What effect do you think the Persian Gulf War had on Timothy McVeigh? It said that he was involved with bulldozing people on the highway of death as Iraqi soldiers retreated after surrender.
Well, he was shocked by it. He also got the Bronze Star. He was a great marksman, and he did his share of shooting soldiers, but he was appalled at the civilians and the children. This is why it's so ironic. He killed all those children as though he got up in the morning to kill the children in the nursery in that building. He says in one of his statements that he says, I did it, and he says, I did it because he didn't want to spend the rest of his life in a box. He could live 30, 40 more years. And then as he wrote me, he said, I'd rather have federally assisted suicide, which is how you term the injection in your arm, than a lifetime in a box. Because he saw there was no way out. He could have sung, but he didn't. He could have said who else was involved in this, but he did not. He was a complex character. And endlessly interesting, I thought, and should have been kept alive so that we could find out who these other people were.
Would you put Timothy McVeigh in the same category as Muhammad Atta?
No. Muhammad Atta, well, we don't know that story either. Muhammad Atta was obviously a Muslim zealot. Also in Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, there's another question that goes unanswered. The head of the Pakistan Secret Service was in Washington a week or so before 9/11. While he was there, and it was just a ceremonial visit with the head of the CIA, they worked together, and he sent back word to Islamabad for one of his henchmen to wire $100,000 to Muhammad Atta in the United States, which was duly done. The FBI, I think it was, the Wall Street Journal, is where I got the story from, only said American Secret Services found out about this. They complained to the Pakistani government, what is the head of your Secret Service in Washington telling somebody to send $100,000 to a guy that we now know was the lead bomber, lead hijacker, just a week before 9/11. Times of India published the whole story. Wall Street Journal did a pretty good version for them. Now, shouldn't that be examined? Wouldn't Congress be interested in what this guy in Washington, meeting with all of our top secret people, says, okay, send him $100,000. Not one more word. Not one more word. Now, in a country with any curiosity, in a public that was informed of anything, there would be a great deal of outcry. I couldn't imagine this happening in England. There'd be questions in Parliament. The papers would be full of it until it was solved. This couldn't happen in Italy, which dearly loves a conspiracy. Or Germany. In the United States, everybody listens to 19th century Fox TV news, in which a bunch of loons just scream and scream and scream. And with each scream, they tell another lie. How are we ever going to have an informed citizenry? Which means then, how can we have an informed election?
So what's it like for you, Gore Vidal, to go back and forth between Italy and the United States through this period?
Let's clear up one thing. The right wing has been desperate to explain to Americans that I live in Italy. I'm an expatriate. He hates America just because I dislike them. I have had a house in California for 30 years. I've had a house in southern Italy for 30 years. Sometimes I am there when I'm working, but I've always been involved in American politics and in American history. That is a fact, but you can look at a long line of books to attest to that fact. The idea of geography is very exciting to people because I think it's only 7% of the American people have passports. Only 7% have been abroad. Not counting the ones who were sent in the military, of course, but 7% have voluntarily gone abroad. It's a tiny percent of those in Congress who've been abroad. Bush had never set foot in Europe before he became president. He spent 10 minutes in China when his father was ambassador there and obviously never went outside the compound. What I have to do a lot of times in Europe is explain to them, no, Americans are not stupid. They think, when they meet them, they think they're very stupid because they don't know anything. I said, they are not stupid at all. As a matter of fact, I think we're rather brighter than the average. But we're ignorant, which means not knowing. We have no information because it isn't given to us. Our public schools are a scandal. They stopped teaching geography in 1950 in most of the public schools. By which time we were a global empire. We have a global empire, nobody knows where anything is. Nobody knows any languages. So our statesmen go abroad and people laugh at them because they are so dumb, or seem to be so dumb.
Gore Vidal, essayist and historian. You are listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with him in a minute.
Thank you.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're spending the hour with Gore Vidal. His latest book is Dreaming War, Blood for Oil and the Cheney Bush Junta. It is published by Nation Books. The Nation sponsored a major event with Gore Vidal in the last few weeks at the Society for Ethical Culture in New York. In that event, Gore Vidal, the essayist and historian, began by giving a speech.
There are a couple of quotations I'd like to throw out to sort of set a theme to why we are here. There's a quotation from Benjamin Franklin, and you cannot find it in any of the high school history books, and not even in proper history books, except rarely. And it occurred, Franklin has always been depicted as one of the great bores of the founding fathers, and he, of course, was one of the most interesting. In 1789, he was at Philadelphia for the making of the Constitution. He's old, dying, and he finally read the handiwork of his fellow conventioneers, and he didn't like it. But he thought about it, and then he got up and he made a very interesting speech. He said, I think that we should accept this Constitution for all of its errors and omissions. At that time, the Bill of Rights was not in there. I think because it will give us, for a course of years, good government, which is what we need right now, and then in due course, as it would give good, it may be a blessing to the people if well administered. And I believe that this is likely to be well administered. And then, only end due to the corruption of the people in despotism, which will be the only form of government suitable for them. This is as dark a statement as anyone has ever made. They got around to the best of the high school history books I saw. American Pageant, I think it is, said that they were so afraid for Franklin. He kept going to dinner parties, and his conversation was quite brilliant. They were terrified that he would give his true opinion of how this thing would end. So they had a couple of young men going around with him, sitting on either side. So when Benjamin Franklin said, well, let me tell you about the Constitution, they'd say, ah, could you pass the salt, Mr. Franklin? I thought of that, needless to say, when Franklin's prophecy came true in December 2000, when the Supreme Court bulldozed its way through the Constitution in order to select as their president the loser in the presidential election of that year. Despotism is now securely in the saddle. Is it due to the corruption of the people? Well, I thought, well, what is corruption? The founding fathers were always, many of them, on the verge of it. Others in the Congresses were, the blankets didn't get to Valley Forge because it couldn't pass Congress that was sitting in Philadelphia. Corruption has always been with us, but when it becomes so total that you allow an election, and to make no contest, there was no outcry across the country when this terrible manipulation took place. And then, of course, Enron and Anderson. It is taken for granted that these great companies are like this, that CEOs are taking all the money that is not nailed down, and people out of work with no relief to fall back upon. So now I think what we might chat about is that despotism is really in the saddle, and the old republic is a shadow of itself, and we now stand in the glare of a nuclear world empire with a government that sees as its true enemy we, the people, deprived of our electoral franchise. War is the usual aim of despots, and serial warfare is what we are going to get, unless with help from well-wishers in new old Europe and from ourselves, awake at last we can persuade this peculiar administration that they are acting on their own and against all our history. The other night on CNN, I brought the admirable Aaron Brown to a full stop. I do not do 19th century Fox. I brought him to a full stop with, not with Franklin, but with President John Quincy Adams, who said in the 1820s on the subject of our fighting to liberate Greece from Turkey, "The United States goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. If the United States took up all foreign affairs, she might become the dictatress of the world, but she would no longer be the ruler of her own spirit or soul." Should we be allowed in 2004 to hold a presidential election here in the homeland, I suspect we shall realize that the only regime change that need concern our regained spirit or soul is in Washington. President Adams is long since dead, and we have now been in the empire business since at least 1900 with the conquest of the Philippines. The local population did not want us there. We promised them independence. We killed 220,000 of them while subduing them. A few years ago, there was a significant exchange between the then General Colin Powell and the then statesperson Madeleine Albright. Like so many civilians, she was eager to use our troops against one of our many, many, many enemies. Everywhere we look, there's somebody lurking who might one day find a special death ray and turn it on us. One could hardly sleep at night knowing these dangers all around us. When Powell said no, she said, "What's the point of having all this military and not using it?" He said, "They are not toy soldiers. But in the interest of fighting communism, we did spend trillions of dollars until we are now threatening to sink under the wet weight of so much weaponry, much of it we have shifted over on to Afghanistan and Iraq." I suppose it was inevitable that sooner or later a new generation would get the bright idea. You read that thing in the Sunday Times today on the neocons and their background intellectually, which turns out to be from a book by my friend Saul Bellow called Ravelstein, is that it?
Well, first Leo Strauss.
Yeah, Leo Strauss, who was actually a nice old-fashioned classicist, but he's been taken up by Wolfowitz and Cheney and the lot as a kind of guru, since he seems to believe empire is very important and empire is based classically on force. So why stop fooling around with diplomacy and treaties and coalitions and just use our military power to give orders to the rest of the world? A year or two ago, a pair of neoconservatives put forward this exact notion, Mr. Kagan and the young Mr. Crystal. I responded in print that if we did so, we would have perpetual war for perpetual peace, which is not good for business. Then the Cheney-Bush junta seized power. Although primarily interested in oil reserves, they like the idea of playing soldiers too, and if you call it a war, you have wartime powers for the president. Last summer, Congress received from the administration a document called the National Security Strategy of the United States. As the historian Joseph Stromberg observed, it must be read to be believed. The doctrine preaches the desirability of the United States becoming, to use Adams' word, dictatress of the world. It also said, used to be Nicaragua is quite enough, you know, now it's going to be Korea, China. It also assumes that the president and his lieutenants are morally entitled to govern the planet. It declares that our best defense is a good offense. The doctrine of preemption is next declared. As a matter of common sense, they write, and self-defense, America will act against emerging threats before they are fully formed. Now, this is a kind of madness. This is not what we started the country for. It's not what the rest of the world wants. I mean, it is as if, I'm sure, at this very moment, good General Ashcroft, brave officer of the junta that he is probably up in Utah arresting Mormon boys before they grow up and then kidnap 8 girls for future wives. They're going to do it. We know it. We know the danger. If you put them all in prison, in concentration camps, those girls are safe, thank God. Danger, danger everywhere we look. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says that only Congress can declare war. But Congress surrendered that great power to the president in 1950 and has never taken it back. As ex-Senator Simpson, and he was one of my favorite clowns, said so cheerily on TV the other evening, the people of the United States don't declare war. The commander-in-chief does. So in great matters, we are not guided by law, but by faith in the president, whose powerful Christian beliefs preach real faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. In response to things not seen, the USA Patriot Act was rushed through Congress 45 days after 9/11. We are expected to believe that its carefully crafted 342 pages were written in that short time. Actually, it reads like a continuation of Clinton's post-Oklahoma City Anti-Terrorist Act. The Patriot Act makes it possible for government agents to break into anyone's home when they are away, conduct a search, and keep the citizen indefinitely from finding out that a warrant was issued or not. They can oblige librarians to tell them what books anyone has withdrawn. If the librarian refuses, he or she can be criminally charged. They can also collect your credit reports and other sensitive information without judicial approval or the citizen's consent. Finally, all this unconstitutional activity need not have the slightest connection with terrorism. Early last month, the Justice Department leaked Patriot Act II, known as the Domestic Security Enhancement Act, as of January 9, 2003. It has not yet gone to Congress, but it has certainly been leaked, and I saw parts of it. Here's a provision. If an American citizen, born American citizen, has been accused of supporting an organization labeled as terrorist by the government, he can be deprived of his citizenship, even if he had no idea the organization had any link to terrorism. Provision of Act II is also made for more searches and wiretaps without warrant, as well as Section 201, secret arrests. In case a citizen tries to fight back in order to retain the citizenship he or she was born with, those federal agents who conduct illegal surveillance with the blessing of high administration officials are immune from legal action. A native-born American deprived of citizenship would presumably be deported, as today a foreigner-born person can be deported. Also, according to American citizens, the provision has some wonderful language in it. It says he can be he's stripped of his citizenship, deported from the United States. Then they suddenly thought, well, what country would want him, you know? We better rephrase this. Because he can't, of course, get a passport, as he doesn't have citizenship. So the thoughtful devisors of our domestic security enhancement authorizes the Attorney General to deport him, quote, to any country or region, regardless of whether the country or region has a government. Well, it sounds like heaven to me. Anyway, that's how you get rid of the Bill of Rights in one big sweep. Back in 39, our greatest historian, Charles A. Beard, wrote, "The destiny of Europe and Asia has not been committed under God to the keeping of the United States, and only conceit, dreams of grandeur, vain imaginings, lust for power, or a desire to escape from our domestic perils and obligations could possibly make us suppose that Providence has appointed us his chosen people for the pacification of the earth. Those Americans who refuse to plunge blindly into the maelstrom of European and Asiatic politics are not defeatist or neurotic. They are giving evidence of sanity, not cowardice, of adult thinking as distinguished from infantilism. They intend to preserve and defend the Republic. America is not to be Rome or Britain. It is to be America."
Gore Vidal, essayist and author. He has written the books Dreaming War, Blood for Oil, and the Cheney-Bush Junta, as well as Perpetual War for Perpetual Peace, his latest two books. And that does it for today's program. He was speaking at the Society for Ethical Culture, an event sponsored by The Nation magazine in the last few weeks here in New York. And today we are launching our newly designed website at www.democracynow.org. We hope you will visit it. A very special thanks to Eric Goldhagen and Jesse Hirsch of openflows.org and Christos Tavares of stosmedia.com, as well as our senior producer, Chris Abrams, who shepherded us through this whole process. We'd love to get your comments at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. And by the way, if you would like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Quddus, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, with help from Noah Reibel, Vilfit Soros. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. And, special thanks to Uri Gallet, Angela Alston, Emily Kunstler, Orlando Richard, Simba Russo, Johnny Sender, Karen Renucci, Fatima Mojadidi, Dennis Moynihan, Jenny Filippazzo. Again, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for being with us.